Good afternoon, everyone. I'm opening the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on today, Tuesday, April 14th, 2015. Welcome. So we have a packed room today. I'm so glad a lot of people are here interested in what we're going to be talking about. I wanted to let everyone know that there is overflow seating available in committee rooms E and F. We're going to start out today by having a work session on House Bill 2762, and then we're going to have an informational meeting on carbon policy. That's going to last about 30 minutes. So those folks who are scheduled to talk at the informational meeting, the work session is only going to take about 3 or 4 minutes, so you can come on into the room if you're in one of the overflow rooms. After the informational meeting, I'm going to open a public hearing on all three of the carbon bills that are up today. We have one panel of speakers from each bill that is going to provide an explanation about what each bill does. I've asked that they limit the time so that we have time to hear from people who have come in today to sign up to speak on those bills. When those panels have finished, I'm going to begin calling people up in the order that you've signed up for the bills. And we're going to be prepared, please, to limit your testimony to no more than 2 minutes at a time. 2 minutes in total, and we will be keeping track of that today. And we do have a hard stop at 5 o'clock today, so I already know with the list we are unfortunately not going to be able to get through everyone, but we do plan to get through as much as we can today in terms of public testimony. Okay, with that, I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2762. Beth, can you remind us a little bit about this bill, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2762 would, effective July 1, 2021, prohibit school districts that provide breakfast or lunch at a school site from using polystyrene foam plates, trays, food containers, or food packaging unless the school district participates in a recycling program for foam. It also directs the Department of Education to provide an extension for districts that are able to show a financial hardship from complying with the prohibition on the use of the polystyrene. There's a fiscal statement up on OLIS. There's no revenue impact. And the amendment in front of you is the Dash 5 amendment, which combines the Dash 1 and the Dash 4 and also makes some other conforming language changes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Beth. And I just wanted to thank Representative Nose and Representative Johnson for the work that they did in getting this bill into the final shape that we see before it today with the Dash 5 amendments. I think we've come to a great place where we're doing something good for the environment, but really considering how the impact on the schools are going to be.
Chair Vega Peterson, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated 4-9 of 15.
Rep. Johnson moves the Dash 5 amendments dated 4-9-15. Is there any discussion? Is there Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, the hearing we had on this bill was a good hearing. Obviously, the kids were very enthusiastic about their idea. But I was concerned about the potential negative financial impact on school districts. We did hear from some folks representing school lunch programs who said that although they may like to comply with this, it would be difficult for them to do that without compromising the quality of their product or their services to kids. So we basically accomplished that by line 11 of the Dash 5 amendments, which changes the word may to shall. So meaning Department of Ed shall give an exemption to those districts who can demonstrate that these criteria would create financial hardships for them. So those that want to comply can. Those who cannot will not be required to. So I think it's in a good place.
Thank you. Further discussion on the amendment? Kate? Is there any objection? Okay. So we'll move the amendment. All right. And
Chair Vega Peterson, I move House Bill 2762 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Rep. Johnson moves House Bill 2762 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Hurd.
Aye.
Representative
Holding. Aye.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative
Benz. That's okay, Tracy.
Did you call me? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Representative Widener.
Excused.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bearden.
Aye.
Chair Vega-Peterson.
Aye. The motion passes. All right. I'm going to assign Representative Nose to carry the bill. There you are. Thank you for being here. We just passed your bill, so so all your work is done. All right. Thank you so much. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2762 and open the informational meeting on carbon policy. So I think we're going to need one more chair. So we're going to have Matt Rodriguez, Sean Penrith, Jeff Renfo, and Russ Beaton. If you are in the room, and please come forward.
No.
Oh, yes, and I do want to let you know that we don't have amendments ready on the other two bills that were scheduled for work session today, so we are carrying those over until Thursday. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here today. Mr. Rodriguez, I understand you have a plane to catch, so why don't we go ahead and get started with you?
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm Matt Rodriguez. I'm the Secretary for Environmental Protection for the state of California. And I was asked to just very briefly touch upon three issues. Essentially, the experience that California has had with its cap-and-trade system. To look at what we've done with the revenue that's been generated by the cap-and-trade program in California. And also to talk about how we've been dealing with environmental justice issues that are associated with the implementation of a cap-and-trade program. California's cap-and-trade program really originated from legislation that was adopted in 2006, known as AB 32. And AB 32 directed the Air Resources Board to develop programs to reduce California's carbon emissions to 1990 levels by the year 2020. Frankly, we looked at a number of different ways to accomplish that objective, and the cap and trade program is one of only a number of programs. We also have a renewable portfolio standard that encourages renewable energy. We have energy efficiency programs. We're promoting electric vehicles in the state of California, and we also have a low carbon fuel standard, among others. But cap and trade has become perhaps the best known of these programs. We adopted this program because it puts a price on carbon to and carbon emissions to incentivize reductions in those emissions. It also provides some flexibility to the regulated entities. And it also, by having a cap, it assures it will be meeting our targets. Currently, the cap and trade program covers 85% of the emissions in California, and that applies to all our large industrial segments. And this year, the program was extended to those who sell fuel in California and natural gas to residential and commercial customers. The emissions are regulated, and we know how many emissions there are in California through third-party verifications. And then what happens is at the end of the compliance period, emitters of carbon are required to show allowances or offsets that meet their emissions targets. Offsets are a special category of projects where you can reduce greenhouse gas emissions by investing, for example, in reducing methane from mines or by carbon sequestration and healthy forest management. No more than 8%, however, of the allowances can be coming from these offset programs. Since the program was initiated in and we had our first auctions under the program in 2012, there have been 10 auctions, and we are pleased to report that all those auctions have gone very, very well. Recently, we linked our program with a program that is very similar to California's in the Canadian province of Quebec. What that means is that allowances that are sold as part of the Quebec program can be used in California, and California allowances can be used in Quebec. And I'm pleased to report that just yesterday, the province of Ontario indicated that it is looking at the adoption of a cap and trade program, and its intent is to link with California's program. Now, I should say that in order to link our program, we need to make certain findings in California, and so there's an awful lot of work that we'll have to do before we could link our programs, but we are interested in working with Ontario in the future. As to the effects of the program, we're constantly monitoring the effects of the program on the California economy as well as our manufacturing and industrial base. We just completed a scoping plan last year. We do a plan every 5 years to sort of track where we are in meeting our targets. It looks like we will meet our 2020 targets, and it looks like we will be doing so without damage to the California economy. In fact, it looks like the California economy is recovering quite nicely from the recession that struck the entire country several years ago. In fact, it's been reported that just recently California's economy got to the point where if California were its own country, it would have the seventh largest economy in the world. So we're constantly monitoring the impacts of this program on the economy, but from where we sit at this point, it looks like it's all very positive. Now, let me say that to date, the 10 auctions that we've had have produced about $1.6 billion. That money has been put in a greenhouse gas reduction fund, and that money is then used to further reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state through a variety of programs. We've adopted an investment plan at the direction of the legislature. These investment plans are three-year plans, and they direct how we can use the money from the greenhouse gas reduction fund in various programs throughout the state. As I said, the primary purpose for the use of the funds has to be to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but if there are co-benefits that can be derived, then that's appropriate as well. So we are looking at whether there are areas where we can, for example, invest in healthy forests and urban forests in some of our urban communities, and a co-benefit of that is not only do we sequester carbon, but we make those communities cooler when we experience warmer days. So we're using the funding in this current fiscal year. There's $832 million that's been budgeted for these programs. The governor's draft budget has $1 billion set aside for programs next year, though we will note that in the February auction, California did take in $624 million. So it may be that we'll have more than $1 billion that we can invest in the next year, but we will work on that as we go through the budget process. I'll just conclude by saying that one of the issues that came up when we were looking at our cap and trade program was the question of environmental justice and what we were doing to help the communities where you find some of these emissions coming from. And so we have developed what we call Cal EnviroScreen, which is a tool that looks at 12 different environmental indicators throughout the state, such as PM2.5 or ozone or proximity to hazardous waste sites, and assesses all the communities in California at a census tract basis using this information. We also have then 7 socioeconomic indicators that we look at that identify those communities that, because of certain issues such as a large percentage of the population living below the poverty line, are having difficulty addressing some of these environmental issues. Under legislation sponsored by our Senate President Pro Tem, Senator Kevin De Leon, in 2012, 25% of the proceeds from the cap-and-trade auctions have to be spent in these communities that have been identified as disadvantaged. They have to benefit from the expenditure. 10% of the expenditure has to take place exactly in the communities themselves. And these can be used for programs such as improving the building stock in these communities to make them more energy efficient, efficient. We're looking at improving public transit in these areas. There's a wide variety of programs to help these communities. So that, in a nutshell, is the situation in California right now. We are looking at identifying targets for the next 15 years, and in the governor's State of the State speech, he suggested that we will be looking at reducing petroleum use in cars and trucks by 50% by the year 2030. We'd like to have 50% of our energy from renewable sources by the year 2030. We want to make our buildings more efficient by 2030 as well. We're also looking at short-lived climate pollutants and dealing with them. And we're looking at how we can work with our agricultural sector to sequester carbon in agricultural practices. So that, in a nutshell, is the California program. And if you've got any questions, I'm available to answer any of them. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Why don't we go ahead and hear from Mr. Penrith.
Good afternoon, Chair Pedersen and members of the House Committee. My name is Sean Penrith. I'm the Executive Director of the Climate Trust. We are an NGO established in 1997 in response to the Oregon Carbon Dioxide Standard in 1997. And we take investment proceeds from regulated utilities under this standard, and we invest them in the very offset projects that Mr. Rodriguez mentioned, creating offsets in the forestry and agricultural sector to retire them on behalf of the contributing utilities. The Climate Trust has engaged in research on existing carbon pricing mechanisms around the world, and last year we released a paper titled The Evaluation of Potential Carbon Pricing Mechanisms for the State of Oregon, in which we examined these existing mechanisms based on carbon reduction, jobs, GDP, and social equity. I'd like to share some of the results experienced by our domestic cap and trade programs in northeastern U.S. and California, which we believe illustrate the fact that emission reductions and positive economic impact are not mutually exclusive. I'll also cover some of the highly visible corporations that we are working with that are taking a meaningful position on putting a price on carbon internally and their results. In terms of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative Cap and Trade Program in northeastern U.S., the first 3 years of the program, the cap and trade program contributed $1.6 billion in economic impact to the Northeast region and added 16,000 job years to the region. The most recent auction caused the program to surpass $2 billion in cumulative auction proceeds 5 years ahead of their target slated for 2020. Just in the February 2015 auction, $84 million was generated at a per allowance price of $5.41, which was the highest ever for this market. When the New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, pulled the state out of the REGI program in 2011, the estimates are that the state lost $144 million worth of auction revenue due to this decision. And it was also estimated that the state suffered an additional loss of $387 million through 2020 by removing the state from the program. I'm going to build a little bit on what Mr. Rodriguez said in California. It has been very successful from a fiscal standpoint. The state added 491,000 jobs in the program's first year and a half, so 18 months, 490,000 jobs. This is a 3.3% growth rate, which outpaces the 2.5% growth rate nationwide in the exact same period. California's GDP also grew during the first 2 years of the program, while capped emissions dropped 4%. California has added more jobs than any other state during the economic recovery, and it has attracted $21 billion in venture capital investment, more than any other of all the other states in this country combined, while its core clean economy grew 10 times faster than any other sector in the state. The cap and trade revenues total California have surpassed $1.6 billion. Like REGI, this is a significantly higher number than expected at this point in the program. In addition to the transportation improvements, over $1.7 billion is expected to be spent in the coming years on affordable housing and sustainable communities program in California, which encourages the development of affordable housing close to transit and creates more walk and bike-friendly communities. On the corporate level, the Carbon Disclosure Project tracks climate change strategies being pursued by the world's top companies. In 2013, they reported that 29 companies in the United States were internally pricing carbon. These prices vary from $6 to $60 per metric ton, depending on the company and the sector. The Climate Trust itself works with a number of these firms, which include Microsoft, Disney, and CH2M Heal, to supply them voluntary offsets for their own internal compliance uses. Companies often use carbon offsets to meet compliance obligations under regulatory emission trading programs. CDP determined that the use of offsets does not cause companies to pollute more. In fact, most companies that used offsets did so after addressing emissions within their direct control and applied the offsets to emissions outside their control, such as from supply chain activities. Thus, the use of offsets increased these companies' emission mitigation impact by 25%. To conclude, experiences from other jurisdictions here in the U.S. prove that it is possible to institute pollution reduction programs without compromising economic prosperity or social equity. Moreover, these programs provide one possible innovative solution to compliance with EPA's Clean Power Plan, which provides regional linking and adds needed market liquidity and protects against economic leakage effects of single-state legislation. For Oregon, we believe the most effective carbon policy will be one that not only ensures the state meets its emission reduction targets, it will be a program, or should be a program, which facilitates linkage, cost containment by the way of offsets and price reserves, and targeted reinvestment into low carbon economy initiatives, thereby offering the benefits of economic growth while providing greater environmental equity to Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For the record, I'm Jeff Renfro with the Northwest Economic Research Center with Portland State University, and I have a few slides for you guys.
Okay. Yeah, I think that would be easiest. Somewhat limited. We're not wireless keyboards yet here.
So I'm going to very briefly talk about results out of British Columbia, which implemented a carbon tax in 2008. And then I'm going to talk about the results of the research that my research center worked on that came out of SB 306 that we completed and presented to the legislature in December of last year. So as I said, British Columbia implemented a carbon tax in 2008. The carbon tax is applied to fossil fuels that are going to be combusted in British Columbia, which is a significant portion of the emission source in BC. The tax started at $10 per ton in 2008. It increased by $5 per ton per year until it hit its cap of $30 per ton, where it currently is. As you can see from this slide, British Columbia is generating a significant amount of revenue from this tax. They intend the tax to be revenue neutral. So they collect the revenue, and they use that mostly for corporate and personal income tax cuts. There's also low-income assistance and a few smaller programs like targeted investment in or targeted property tax cuts for agricultural land. As you can see, they've actually given away a little bit too much money. So at this point, the tax has been slightly revenue negative. This is a graph that shows the per capita energy-related greenhouse gas emissions in British Columbia versus the rest of Canada. So after the tax was implemented, there is a reduction in per capita emissions. It's actually not as big as the per capita reductions in the rest of Canada. And this is largely due to the fact that British Columbia, even before 2008, had an electricity sector that was almost exclusively hydro. There was a little bit of wind in there, but their electricity was basically carbon neutral or carbon-free before this started. The rest of Canada has had a pretty significant switch from coal-generated electricity to gas-generated electricity. So BC has had a similar reduction in emissions, even without the ability to reduce emissions in the electricity sector. So that's against GDP growth. So when we look at this, So in 2008, when the whole world basically went into recession, Canada and the rest of the BC had economic shrinkage. They went into recession. And then Canada as a whole came out of the recession a lot quicker than a lot of other countries. So you can see in 2010, the economy starts to recover. BC's recovery is a little bit slower than the rest of Canada, but then it actually picks up, and it's been faster than the rest of Canada in the last few years, and it's actually caught up to where the rest of the country is. So from a research perspective, it's probably too early to isolate the effect of the carbon tax in British Columbia. What we can say definitively is that British Columbia's economy is normal, it's growing, it looks like a regular developed country economy. At the same time, they have a carbon pricing fully incorporated into their economy. So from there, I'm going to move into our research. And the British Columbia tax served as sort of a starting point for us when we looked at carbon pricing policies around the world. When we first looked at this, British Columbia was really the only one that was comprehensive. It was economy-wide. We had a few years of data to look at to see that it was working. So we took that as a starting point. So the carbon tax that we imagined when we were creating these estimates, it's applied to fossil fuels that are going to be combusted in Oregon, plus electricity that's generated outside of the state, but it's imported for Oregon consumption. And then we look at different ways of using that revenue to mostly cut corporate and personal income taxes. We also look at targeted reinvestment, low-income assistance, and things like large public works projects. So the first thing I'll show you is this is what we expect the emissions reduction to be. So that green line on the top is the business as usual, or it's our forecasted emissions with no carbon tax. So it looks pretty flat, but there's actually a small increase. It's about a 10% increase over the 20 years that we're looking at. The other lines on there, the dashed line, that's our 1990 level of emissions, just for reference. At first, that top red line is 10% below 1990 levels, which is our 2020 goal. And then the bottom red line is 75% below 1990 levels, which is our 2050 goal. So looking at this, if you look at the sort of burnt orange line, that's at $30 per ton, which is where British Columbia is right now. So we get below those 1990 levels, but we don't actually hit that 2020 goal. To hit that goal on the timeline that the state is shooting for it, you'd need a carbon price of about $60 per ton. Another thing to note is that bottom purple line is the highest price that we looked at. So that's a carbon tax that's capped out at $150 per ton. Even with a very aggressive carbon price, we still wouldn't hit our long-term 2050 goal. This is basically the flip of that last graph. So we're looking at the revenues generated from this tax. Like in British Columbia, this would be a pretty significant amount of revenue. At $30 per ton, we would generate about $1.3 billion annually. At $100 per ton, that would be about $3.5 billion annually. So to give you a sense of scale, if we took the general and lottery fund budget and cut that in half so we had an annual number, this would be about 17% of that. So it's a significant amount of money that could be used to offset existing taxes or fees. So in our study, we looked at a variety of scenarios, but I want to focus on these two extremes here. So in the middle, there is a dashed dotted line, and that's our forecasted employment going into the future. So that's our economic baseline that we're judging everything against. The green line that's just slightly on top of that, that's our scenario that had the highest positive employment impact. So that was giving all of the revenue to the government, and the government basically hires people. That's sort of its function. So according to some economic indicators, that's not the best thing to do, but if you want employment, give money to the government, let them employ people. So it's barely above the forecasted baseline. When you look at the red line on the bottom, that assumes that the revenue is collected. It's $100 per ton tax, so it's a pretty aggressive tax. The revenue is collected, and it's just put into a financial reserve. So it's not used to offset those front-end price increases. In the same way that the most positive one is barely above our baseline, our most negative employment impact is just a little bit below our baseline. And when I say a little bit, I mean a little bit relative to the size of the economy. It's about a 1.5% in decline in expected employment. So even with that extremely negative, we think negative and pretty unrealistic scenario, employment is still growing in the state. So really, even when we look at scenarios where, as researchers, we were really trying to push to see kind of what the extremes of this policy would be, we still have economic growth. It's less than what it would be without the tax, but it's still there. So this is a very busy chart, but I just want to talk about some of the trends that we saw. So this is looking at all of the scenarios that we ran. It normalizes the results. So we take the mean jobs impact per $1 million in revenue collected. So the takeaway from this is in order for the policy to be have a net positive impact on the economy, in the scenarios we ran, we think that there needs to be some sort of business support, whether that's cuts in the corporate income tax cut or whether that's targeted investment dollars for industries that might be negatively impacted. If you give all of the revenue to personal income tax cuts or something like a dividend, we see net negative impacts. Again, they're small relative to the size of the economy, relative to what we expect. But we just see consumption, that increase in consumption is just not enough to offset the negative impacts associated with the front-end price increases. We also incorporated into almost all of the scenarios using the transportation-related revenues to fund the highway trust fund. So according to current constitutional requirements, if the tax is applied to transportation fuels, that revenue would have to go to the highway fund. So the impact of that is that revenue, depending on the year that you're looking in and depending on what you're using the revenue for, that's about 41 to 51% of the total revenues. So it's a significant amount of money, and that gets spread around the state in what amounts to a large public works program. So we see positive economic impacts associated with that road construction and maintenance. With that, I think I'm going to finish. I wish I could talk more, but I have a limited amount of time. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you guys have.
Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah.
Professor Beaton.
Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to appear before you here today. For the record, my name is Russ Beaton, and I'm an emeritus professor of economics at Willamette, across the street, where I gazed at the yellow man on the chapel out of my office for many years. I'd first like to offer a few words detailing my longtime interest in the area of energy and environment. My experiences include the following. They started with when I served on an energy task force in 1973, appointed by Governor Tom McCall. It was June 1973, and that task force was formed because we had a drought at that time and were anticipating energy shortages in the fall. The main thing, however, that task force did, as I recall, is we predicted the OPEC oil embargo, which occurred in October of 1973. And it was that task force that recommended the odd-even gas rationing deal, which older people here in the audience may remember. Tom McCall, as was his habit, took that information and wrote it around the nation like a surfboard. And till the degree that people were saying, what did Oregon know about this energy thing that we didn't know? Well, it was largely due to his energy advisor who convened that task force. That person also developed OLIS, the Oregon Legislative Information Systems, which keeps us all sane these days. Maybe it keeps some of us insane. I don't know. experience made me remember and think we need to follow energy. As economists, we really hadn't ever paid any attention to energy as a significant resource up to that period of time. Subsequently, in 1974, I helped write the legislation that created the Oregon Department of Energy, which was created in 1975 session. I developed a course in environmental economics at Willamette in 1972, and an energy economics course in 1975, both of which I taught for the rest of my career, pretty much. I've co-authored with a biologist, Chris Mazur, three books in the areas of sustainable economic development. All of those have energy sections in them. I've learned a few things by this long little voyage. An economy is fundamentally a use of energy to convert natural resources into desirable or necessary products. To be sure, money and goods and services change hands, but at its roots, economic activity is a process of managing energy flows and meeting human wants. Without energy, there is no economy. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, without energy, there is no environmental deterioration as well. And that's the common bond that energy forms between environment and economics. I've come to believe over the years that a language of energy flows is really a more effective way to create policy and understand the connections between economics and environment than the language strictly of money. Unfortunately, you people always have to budget money, not energy flows, though, and I feel sorry for you. But one other thing I've learned is that any successful policy must begin with addressing and tracking the injection of carbon into the system, as all of these people have certainly said very eloquently today. A policy that treats economics and environment in conflict with each other, I believe, is doomed to fail in the long run, and that's the challenge that we're looking at in broad terms as we address this problem, this question today. Specifically today, though, I wish to speak primarily to the cap and dividend feature of House Bill 3250. Excuse me. This is designed as a revenue-neutral mechanism whereby the fees collected are returned to the citizens of Oregon on a per capita basis. Economists identify two bases for taxation. One is to raise revenue. Two is to provide a disincentive for something you don't like. A carbon tax or fee clearly falls in the second category, since our goal is less carbon per unit of economic activity. As has been already mentioned, the fees should be significant. The more significant that they are, the higher the impact, I believe, that you can expect. I like to leave you with three main points. One, I think it's important to structure carbon pricing so that government doesn't come to depend on the revenue. I'm old enough to remember the Laffer curve of the Reagan era, where if you keep raising taxes, ultimately the taxes go to zero because you tax out the element that you're taxing. A cap and dividend returns the dollars to the people. Under a cap and dividend structure, research shows that the lowest two-thirds of the income distribution will get more money back in dividends than they pay in higher energy costs. And that has a feature. We've certainly heard some good words on the social justice income distribution elements of this. That would create a very positive effect in that by returning dollars to the people. As you people know, it probably is politically better when you try to support something that returns dollars to the people as well, since they put you here. Finally, my third point. This will create what I call a stakeholders' purchasing power that will sustain the broader economy. As an economist, as I've observed the meltdown and the painful reconstruction of our economy of the last 7 or 8 years, the big problem that we're having is that purchasing power in the middle class is not as high as it used to be. And this returning money to the folks through a cap and dividend policy will be almost the perfect mechanism for something like that, because data show, I long taught urban economics and regional economics, and I've messed around with local multipliers quite a few times, but the multipliers that local economies receive from purchasing power from people in the middle and lower income levels actually go further to help the economy than multipliers in the higher levels. Wealthier people tend to take their vacations in Tahiti or something like that and don't impact the economy quite as seriously. So I would like to congratulate you for, as public sector representatives, for addressing this crucial issue. I believe it's one that will grow in importance. I know it's late in the session and you've already had quite a bit to do about things like this. I believe that this issue will get more and more strident with each passing session, shall we say. I had the pleasure of observing Oregon's leadership some 40 years ago, and I think you've got a chance to do it again. So good luck to all of you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. So we're going to have some questions now. Before we get started, Secretary Rodriguez, there was a written question, just to see if there's a place where we can get a summary of a summary description of what California is doing with their cap and trade program.
Certainly, you can look at the website for the Air Resources Board, and I've had some pamphlets that I can leave here, which are just describe generally what we've been doing with the program.
That would be so helpful. Thank you so much. Questions for this panel? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Rodriguez, thank you for joining us. Very kind of you to travel up here. Can you? We've been struggling in this committee with a measure of the cost on the one hand and the good done on the other. And do you guys have you guys developed a metric that you can apply to your carbon reduction programs that we can steal from you?
I can't say that we have a metric or an easy formula that you can steal from, but there is the scoping plan that we did last year, which looked at a couple of things. As I said, the success of the program, other areas where we could make changes of the program, and it talked about some of the economic analysis that we've been doing to make sure that we understand the economic impacts of the program. So looking at the scoping plan would be one of the things that we've that I would suggest. Additionally, there are some analyses that we're doing on a sector-by-sector basis to sort of take a look at what the impact of the program is on various sectors in California. So unfortunately, I can't point you to one particular formula or one particular analysis that's out there, but I can say that if you have an interest, we can make available some of the ongoing studies that we've got while we're looking at are we making sure that we've got the right balance in our program.
Follow up. We very much would like those. The challenge for all of us, I think, is to see how much we're investing and what we're getting in return. Mm-hmm. And so, to the extent that we can watch you guys as you, because you're doing this, you've been doing this for a while. And so, if we can see that, we'd love to see how well you're doing. First of all, mm-hmm. and so we can pick and choose among the different paths you're hacking your way through on this in this difficult area. See how well you're doing. But measuring is very difficult. And so, to the extent that you've developed processes, you'd like to see.
I've talked about the fact that, well, two things. One, my intent when I became the secretary for EPA was to sit in a corner office in a large building in Sacramento and make sure our programs were working efficiently. I really didn't intend to go out and talk to legislatures in Oregon or Ontario or Quebec or China about what we were doing in California. But there is interest in what we've been doing in California. And you're correct that what we need to do is do a little bit more in terms of a nice presentation that talks about where we are and what the progress is that we've seen in California. So I'll take that message back, and we will let me work on making something that's accessible to folks who are interested in what we're doing in California, a little bit more accessible than what we've got right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I ask my question, I just wanted to thank you for holding these hearings. I know these are like Professor Beaton said, they're big ideas and they're coming to us near the end of the time that we're able to work on them, but I think they're worth thinking about, and they're very important ideas, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to get this information. For Mr. Rodriguez, can you, my memory, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that California has some of the aspects of our initiative system. And so my question is, when your cap and trade system came into being, was it by a vote of the legislature, or was it by initiative, or was there any type of public votes leading up to the legislature adopting the program? I'm just trying to get a sense of the political history that led to where you are today.
The cap and trade program is part of legislation that was adopted by our legislature in 2006. It identified the overall goal to reduce our emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. So ARB started working on a number of programs to achieve that goal. Now, all those programs that have been adopted by ARB have been subject to a very, very visible and transparent process for their adoption. As well, as you may know, we've included fuels under the cap this year. There was an earlier proposal and initiative that would have prevented us from having fuels under the cap several years ago. Proposition 23, I believe, was the number. And that proposition was defeated at the polls. So there has been a vote not on the overall cap and trade program, but on this idea of whether we should exclude certain segments of the economy from the cap and trade program, and that did not come to pass. So we've got a program right now that covers 85% of our emissions.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, and just kind of following up on that, when California's experiences is Dr. Eaton just described the cap and dividend return, and it seems which returns money to the people. And did California consider that as opposed to a cap and trade? And do you think your reductions in emissions would be just as great with a cap and dividend program as a cap and trade? Because it seems like the cap and trade allows you to reinvest in potentially emission reducing measures. Just sort of curious what your thoughts were, or if you had those thoughts as you were developing your program.
To be totally candid, I'm not entirely up to speed, if you will, on the cap and dividend program, but I can speak to the cap and trade program and the difference between a program such as what we're doing and what British Columbia does with the carbon tax. And let me mention that we've worked collaboratively with British Columbia. British Columbia is part of the Western Climate Initiative, and they're a member of a nonprofit corporation that we have that actually helps to run our program. So even though there's a difference between the British Columbian program and our program, we've still worked collaboratively with them. British Columbia then has the freedom to use the money that they take out of their tax in a wide variety of programs. Because of the nature of our program, we are only using the cap and trade funds to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But as I said, the programs that we're using on, there's a broad base of programs that runs the gamut from transportation programs. We're using apportions to fund our high-speed rail project, for example. There's $200 million set aside in this fiscal year for low carbon transportation, which is encouraging zero emission vehicles, that sort of thing. We've got I forget the actual amount, I think it's $30 million for weatherization projects, and that's going to be used primarily in disadvantaged communities, which will be used to improve the building stock in those areas. We've got a certain amount of money set aside for recycling projects that will reduce methane emissions. So what we're trying to do is find programs that do both the central mission of AB 32, which is reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also help various segments of our economy and really put it back into the money back into the communities. That was part of the purpose of the investment plan that was written a couple of years ago, and we're working on a new investment plan. And so that's one of the things we look at. How can we benefit the communities in California by reinvesting the money? So I'm not too sure how that differs from a cap and dividend program, but we are interested in returning the money back into communities in California.
Could I follow up with Dr. Beaton about that question as far as the cap and dividend program? And did you look at how effective it was in reducing future emissions because of the potential of, I guess, lack of reinvestment of those dollars into programs to further reduce emissions?
Representative Holby, that's a good question. Of course, economists never saw a cap they didn't like. So I'm not against the cap and trade at all. And of course, as the discipline of economics began to think about this policy, the cap and trade is very attractive because of the market mechanism with regard to the dividends themselves. Some of us have come to believe that you know, Wall Street benefits a lot with the whole manipulation of the dividends, and that there's a chance that speculation gets in there and sort of messes up the public policy purposes of it at all. I like what I hear from California as well, but a cap and a dividend puts money back in the community with at the whim of the consumers themselves. And so a lot of us feel that the incentive system would trickle down to people's own behavior themselves as well. And if I'm not mistaken, the California policies will require that the legislature, whoever, make conscious choices about how they inject that money into the system. I would think it might not be a bad feature to allocate some of that money to maybe research for businesses to adjust, or maybe to agriculture or key sectors like that before passing the dividend out completely to the people.
Yes.
Can I add a comment to that? The California Air Resources Board system is very sophisticated in California, because what they've realized is that if they can regulate main sectors of industry and have a trading mechanism, the trading mechanism allows the development of voluntary carbon reduction protocols. So a very good example is the biodigester protocol for manure, processing of manure, which releases methane, or rice paddy cultivation. So ARB has realized that by having the market aspect, develop the protocols, create these voluntary credits that voluntary buyers such as Microsoft buy, basically tees up a whole new system and a sector that can eventually be considered perhaps under the cap. So biodigesters is one of the sectors that ARB is recognizing or considering. So when you have a dividend and you're not supporting the development of new sectors that can help accelerate the attainment of the cost, and I understand receiving a dividend check is wonderful, but if it's not accelerating the attainment, there's a problem. And I think that what California has done is very clever in teeing up the voluntary sectors.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, and just to be mindful of time.
We want to be done quickly.
Yes, we want to be done quickly, and I know that Secretary Rodriguez has to catch a plane,
okay.
So we've only got him for a couple
I'll
minutes.
Ask him my first question, okay. And thank you, Mr. Secretary, for being here. You mentioned California's GDP and the economic indicators seem to be positive since you've employed the carbon tax. How can you tell whether it's due to that or might... Do you have any factors or economic controls built in to determine how California's economy might have grown even better without it? Is there a way you have filters or indicators built into your economic modeling?
Well, we are looking at the economics, but I think one of the other speakers here talked about the job growth in California and how that job growth really does seem to be tied to the a couple of factors that are related to this program, at least. There are jobs being created in the renewable energy sector. There are, and certainly that's one of the ways to reduce emissions. There are jobs that we're seeing in construction industry and the weatherization that we're going to be working on. And then there's just the jobs that are being created in the clean technology sector and the investments that we're attracting to California. California, as you likely know, is a magnet for joint venture capital and venture capital, and we think that that's related to these programs and these incentives that we've got in our programs. Now, we'll continue to assess that, and I don't want to make any false claims that, you know, if we can't justify them, but it is one of the things that we want to look at. We're interested, just as other governments are, in having a strong economy, and so we need to know what's creating these additional jobs, but we see that relationship between these programs and the jobs that are being created.
Follow up. you mentioned there's been about $1.6 billion in revenue that's come in, I guess, as a result of the trading that's occurred. What conversations have you had within California about putting money into R&D? You've got some amazing universities down there that do some great research. And if we're truly serious about making a global impact, wouldn't it be better to put a significant amount of this money into investing in technologies, i.e., as Daimler has done with a new engine for their long-haul trucks, it's doubling the MPG and so forth, technologies that we could develop here in the States and export to those parts of the region where we can really have an impact on carbon output in the developing nations and developing world?
Our Energy Commission and the chair of the Energy Commission has identified certain research areas that we should be looking at. Additionally, I'm the chair of a group that's called the Climate Action Team, which consists of really all the government entities in California that touch some piece of the climate puzzle, and we have a research plan that we've been developing in California to identify those areas where we should be investing in more research. Now, what we want to do, particularly right now at the formative stages of the cap and trade program, is make sure that we're really getting reductions for our investments. And so we really haven't been putting the money from the cap and trade program into research so much because we know that there's an awful lot we can do with that money right now that will lead to more immediate reductions. But I agree with you that research, long-term research, looking at various ways to continue to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, change our energy base is something that we need to pay attention to. And we've been working on identifying those areas where we need to do additional research.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And we're going to be having Minister Hertel mm-hmm. and Elaine Hood up here, I think, in a couple of weeks.
On the 30th.
On the 30th.
Yeah.
So they will be able to explain and answer more questions again as we think of them. But I'm interested in that. I've been working with Elaine for some time now and asked him if he would be interested in coming up, and he's the one who offered up the minister. So that will be good for us to hear about the rest of what you're doing there. So
we've got a very good working relationship with Quebec, and I've made many appearances with Minister Hertel through the years. So you'll have a very good session.
Yeah, unfortunately for scheduling reasons, he couldn't be here today by phone, but we're looking forward to having him. So thank you all very much for your time. I think we could probably spend like a whole week talking with you guys on these really interesting issues. And so thanks so much for taking the time today to come here.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. And I've left the, they're not sales brochures, they're just brochures.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the informational meeting on carbon policy and open a public hearing on House Bills 3250, 3252, and 3470. The first panel that we're going to have come up, it will be Dan Golden and Sydney Scout. Next up after that will be Jana Gastelum, Don Negri, and Maggie Talmadge. So you guys are on deck. So if we have Dan Golden and Sydney Scout here.
They might be in the other room.
No, I think they're right there.
Oh.
Hi, welcome. And just does everybody have?
Actually, it's fine. Just as long as it's projected. I have a slide, but it's just one. I just wanted to show one slide, so we don't need to check through it.
Okay. Is that it?
Yeah.
All right. We're all set. Thank you. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
So for the record, my name is Dan Golden. I have the honor of serving as policy director for Oregon Climate. Oregon Climate, I also, professionally, I work as a chemical engineer and as an economist in energy efficiency management. Oregon Climate, over the past 1 year since we began formal organizing, we've gathered 1,500 volunteers from across the state, including, or at least supporters and hundreds of volunteers, including in Bend, Corvallis, Eugene, Portland, Southern Oregon. We manage primarily off of our tens of thousands of volunteer hours, and 123 have submitted written testimony in favor of HB 3250. The reason that this idea has acquired so much interest so rapidly is, you know, part of it is that all of the leaders in this movement are really behind this price and dividend policy. George Shultz, Bill McKibben, James Hansen, Hank Paulson, Robert Reich, it's an overwhelming preponderance of the people that really dedicate their work to this globally. And I believe that this graph can kind of explain why. I love this data. I think that it really shows how graphically viewing simple data can tell such a powerful story. This is global energy consumption since 1965, published by the BP Statistical Review in Energy. The red line represents fossil fuels increasing, the consumption of fossil fuels globally, and the green line represents renewables. Now, I chose global data because it doesn't really make sense to define energy consumption within the confines of one locality. When we consume iPods that are coming into Oregon that are manufactured in China, we're still consuming that carbon, and it still goes into the atmosphere. So you could look at data just in the United States, and you would see more of a slowdown in energy consumption, and that's because we're exporting a lot of our manufacturing globally. So this graph tells me a few things. The first thing that I want to bring up is that there's no real relationship, and this is to address Representative Holvey's question and others, I believe. There really is no relationship historically between our consumption of green energy and abatement of fossil fuels. If you look at the graph, you'll notice that globally, yes, our renewable energy consumption is growing at an extremely rapid rate. It's growing faster than it ever has in history. And it is true that renewable energy is getting more affordable and more viable all the time. But our consumption of fossil fuels is growing 9 times faster. So there isn't really a relationship between our greater consumption of renewable energy and reduction of fossil fuels. The second thing that you'll notice is that of the three slowdowns that we've seen in fossil fuel consumption since World War II, all three of them were directly related to a real reduction in consumer purchasing power of fossil fuels. That is the 1973 oil crisis, the 1979 oil crisis, and the Great Recession, that consumers respond to price signals, not investments in renewable energy or green energy. So this is why we like to say that a problem adequately stated is very nearly a problem solved, right? This is not a problem of insufficient green energy or insufficient renewable energy. This is a problem of an excess of dirty energy, and that it's too cheap. And that when we address that with a cap or a tax, as any of these bills would do, we have the ability to address the problem at its source. Now, looking at this graph, I think it's clear the lion's share of work to do is in bringing the red line down. It's not in bringing the green line up. And when we price carbon, that's what we're doing rather than investing. So one story that I like to tell. I'm from Southern Oregon. I'm from Ashland. We have this great restaurant called Standing Stone Brewery, and they have this great item on their menu called the 1 Mile Burger, because the cows are raised 1 mile from the restaurant. It's great because it's local. Only problem is we don't have a slaughterhouse, so the cows are all trucked up to Roseburg where they're slaughtered, and then the meat is brought back down to Ashland. Now, I'm not asking that anybody here should necessarily offer the solution to that. It shouldn't be, yeah, they should be doing that on ethanol, or they should be doing it on solar trucks, or they shouldn't be serving beef at all in the first place. Really, what the best solution would be that we have would probably be that we just have a slaughterhouse down in Southern Oregon. But the point is that it's not for us to say that we should continue consuming the same amount of energy, because the problem is not that we need to replace our existing energy stock with green energy. The problem is that we're consuming too much dirty energy. Finally, I want to say that as much work as we have to do in bringing that red line down, and as much, I believe it's 90% of it, that bringing the green line up really is only possible if we have a dividend. Now, I used to work as a chemical engineer here in Salem for a place called Sequential Biofuels. Now, Sequential Biofuels in 2010 was kind of losing all of its competitors because the tax credit, the government tax credit for renewable energy was expiring, and Congress chose not to renew it. So that level of uncertainty in a market is really difficult for people that want to invest, because you may all agree that government investment in R&D is a good idea, but you don't know what's going to happen 10 or 20 years from now. And those are the frames that investors are looking after. When you have a dividend or something that can guarantee the protection of your law by creating stakeholderships among everybody, you sustain not only can you guarantee increasing prices for your commodity into the future, you can guarantee that it's going to stick around, because people will become accustomed to that dividend. It's why the best solutions that we have are the ones that must be the most robust. 3250 is something that's progressive instead of regressive. It's constitutional. It would be possible to use the revenue for a dividend without the amendment of the Constitution to change the Highway Trust Fund provision. It would be able to pass with a simple majority. It builds in no conflicts or dependence on the revenue through any governmental body. It's that nobody would depend on revenue that's designed to vanish. And it would most importantly actually provide a model for federal change, because here's a revenue neutral bill, something that actually shows a transition from dirty energy is possible without burdening low income families. It's possible without ballooning the size of government. It discredits the pernicious myth that climate change is an elaborate hoax that somebody designed to make government bigger. It eliminates all of those myths in a way that actually makes Oregon the best candidate to lead the country with a model.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Hi, Chairperson Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Sydney Scout. I'm 21 years old, and I currently live in Bend, Oregon. And I'm also here to ask for your support of HD 3250, which would put a cap on carbon emissions by auctioning allowances and distributing the revenue back to Oregonians in the form of a dividend check. So because I spent the first 18 years of my life in Alaska, every year I received the reliable, governmentally distributed permanent fund dividend check straight from the pockets of oil companies who use our land. Thanks in large part to this check, I can say that I'll be graduating with a bachelor's degree from OSU Cascades this June, completely debt-free. As a millennial, I can tell you that the coexistence of my current educational and financial situations is very rare. Alaskans love our dividend checks. Because of this extra income, we're not only able to prioritize education, as I have done, but we're able to put money back into our state's economy, afford increased costs of living that come with life in Alaska, and empower new generations of Alaskans to bear the ever-increasing financial burdens of the post-secondary education system and current job market. It's true that not everyone uses their dividend checks directly to pursue post-secondary education, as I have. Some use their dividend checks for more basic survival needs, and also some do spend them superfluously. But risking that a handful of people will spend their yearly dividend to buy a plasma screen is worth it when you allow others to survive more comfortably, pursue education, and solidify their careers. Oil companies have tried to challenge our rights to the permanent fund dividend, but have been met with nearly unanimous opposition among residents across the state. Whether you're from Anchorage, Seward, Fairbanks, or Juneau, your identity as an Alaskan is inextricably tied to the PFD. Thanks to legislation put forward in 1976 by Republican Governor Ray Hammond, which created the permanent fund, Alaskans trust our government and know that they will keep their promises to us rather than compromising with oil companies who don't really have our best interests in mind. Adequate action on climate change requires passing long-lasting legislation that can stand up to the powerful forces of the fossil fuel industry. The only example I can think of where the people have been able to stand up and win against big oil is in my home state. As I come to fall in love with the environment and people of Oregon, I have faith that with a dividend like Alaska's, we'd be able to give power and money to the people of Oregon, too.
Thank you.
And we do. We will show the world how people, our natural world, and the economy can win a stable and prosperous future together.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Any questions? Representative Holby.
Thanks. I'm struggling still a little bit with the concept of the cap and dividend, and not that I'm opposed to giving citizens some money back. That's a great idea, but I worry about the assumption that, I guess, the lack of investment, reinvestment in renewables is necessary from your chart and your comments on that, and as opposed to the California style, which does provide, you know, a lot of potential for reinvesting in future emission reducing technologies and programs. I'm just struggling with that fundamental difference, and I'm really having a hard time getting to where a cap and dividend is really going to accelerate the reduction of emissions compared to the California model.
Sure. Well, so it's an intuitive thing. That's an intuitive thing to say, right? Why not push and pull at the same time? We have money that we're drawing from the fossil fuel company to level the playing field. Why not push on the other side? The first thing I would argue is that it's a cap, right? I mean, the reductions that we should expect are exactly equal to what the cap is. What we do with the revenue will only affect the price of dirty energy. So when we send money back to folks as a form of a dividend, then we should expect that dirty energy will get more expensive. When we invest it in green energy to the effect that it hasn't impacted at all, we should expect that dirty energy will get cheaper because it will supply more energy into the market. But either way, they're going to meet the cap. They're certainly not going to go below it, and we shouldn't expect that they'll go above it. I would also say that really investing in energy, you know, investors aren't looking for tax credits or research grants. They're looking for long-term predictability in the market. I can tell you, I mean, that's what, you know, we have these industries here in Oregon. We have Sequential Biofuels. We have, you know, Brahma Motors in Southern Oregon. These folks, what they need to know is, what will my commodity look like 20 years from now? And, I mean, we can't guarantee that with anything we pass today unless it's something that's non-erodible as a dividend. Does that make sense at all?
Still struggling, but I'll keep thinking about it.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and call up. We're running out of time.
Okay.
Thank you guys so much for your time.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Janet Gastelum, Don Negri, Maggie Tallmadge. Hi, welcome. Do we have Maggie Tallmadge? Okay, please go ahead and get started.
Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm Climate Program Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. It's a pleasure to be here and surrounded by so many people who support climate action and believe that the legislature can show leadership in creating good-paying, clean economy jobs, healthier families, and fair and more equitable communities here in Oregon. We thank you for considering the three bills on the table today and for having the expert panel. We support multiple approaches, but want to speak to the organizing principles behind HB 3252, which we hope would be applied when we design any type of right climate policy for Oregon. First, we should address the root cause of climate pollution, greenhouse gases, and make sure that policy aligns with our state climate goals that were established in 2007. HB 3252 was based on best practices gleaned from the SB 306 economic analysis that NERC carried out. And we wanted to put forward a bill that would create space for dialogue about the best use of carbon revenue in the state. So we believe that any policy that creates revenue should consider the following. It must be equitable. Revenue should be used to support low and moderate income Oregonians and should create opportunities for historically disadvantaged populations. It should take into consideration special populations like rural Oregonians, perhaps. And we support community involvement in the process for designing how we get that type of input. We should use revenue to create opportunities, helping businesses, industries, and households reduce energy waste and obtain access to cleaner, healthier energy is worthy of public investment. And some industries may require transition assistance more than others, and it's fair to weigh those considerations as we come up with an Oregon solution. And we can and should create economic benefits for Oregon. The NERC analysis showed that Oregon's economy can thrive with targeted reinvestment from carbon revenue, and we've seen from both BC and California that economies can perform well, and in fact even better than their neighbors with strong climate policies in place. In fact, during the first 2 years of cap and trade in California, jobs grew by 3.3%, outpacing the rest of the nation. Right now, Oregon isn't doing enough to address climate pollution. While Oregon should be proud of our strong legacy, we're far from reaching our statutory limits on climate-changing pollution. Some Oregon utilities still serve customers with significant amounts of coal power. Homes and commercial buildings aren't built to the high standards for energy efficiency. Public transit does not adequately reach all communities who want and need it. And climate pollution is freely emitted, and society as a whole is expected to pay the consequences. I'll soon be a mom for the second time, and bringing a child into the world is not a decision we make lightly. But I'm buoyed by the groundswell of support that's shown in this room today and the knowledge that thoughtful leadership can turn the tides of history. So thank you for this consideration, for the good work that's ahead of us, and for taking Oregon into a leadership role in addressing climate pollution.
Thank you. Please go ahead. And just as a note, you don't have to get too close to the mic. They're actually really sensitive, and it's harder to hear when they're further away. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the House Committee on Energy and Environment. My name is Margaret Tallmadge, the Environmental Justice Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color. The Coalition is an alliance of 20 culturally specific community-based organizations with representations from six communities of color: African, African-American, Asian and Pacific Islander, Latino, Native American, and Slavic. The coalition supports an equitable carbon pricing program in Oregon that will, one, offer protection from disproportionate financial impacts, while two, creating economic opportunities for communities of color, and three, supporting more resilient, healthy communities. Communities of color make up 25% of Oregon's population, including 40% of children aged 0 to 5. Additionally, people of color support for the environment is generally higher than the white population, on average 20% higher than white Americans. While climate change is a major threat to the quality of life for all Oregonians, it has a disproportionate impact on the physical, mental, financial, and cultural well-being of communities of color and low-income communities. Among other impacts, this includes a limited ability to respond to increasing costs of energy, housing, transportation, and food. Our children and communities already bear the brunt of environmental and economic inequities, such as housing in high traffic corridors. And our lives are literally more threatened by climate impacts than the average Oregonian. Oregon must do more to address climate change and must design and pass equitable carbon management policies. Doing so is a win-win. We have a unique opportunity to mitigate impacts of climate change and to yield economic and environmental benefits in communities most vulnerable to impacts of climate change. But this won't happen by itself. We must be intentional about creating these opportunities. For example, we should maximize connecting new and existing job training and entrepreneurship support efforts within community economic development organizations to investments in residential clean energy and green infrastructure. Other examples of equitable policies include monthly financial assistance to the lowest income household or those on fixed income and living paycheck to paycheck. Annual rebates really do not work for everyone. Also, creating community investment funds, as was done in California under SB 535. The Coalition of Communities of Color supports an equitable carbon pricing program in Oregon that protects households and communities from financial impacts, reinvests a portion of the revenue to provide economic opportunities, and support more resilient communities, and makes the policy development and implementation process inclusive and accountable. Thank you for your time, leadership, and consideration of this extremely important issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Don Negri. I'm a professor of economics at Willamette University, and I teach the environmental economics class that my colleague Russ Beaton, who testified here just a while back, pioneered years ago. As I testify today, I would like to start by calling your attention to the important effects that climate change has already had on Oregon. Record winter temperatures, diminished snowpack, likely future water shortages, and several years of drought in southern Oregon have already had effect on us. Scientists tell us that we are seeing the beginning of an increasingly severe effects that Oregons will experience in the near future. These damages will bring real economic harm to Oregon businesses and to individuals. Scientists have strongly and unambiguously shown that to slow or to roll back climate change, we need to reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases, and especially carbon dioxide. I am here today as a representative of 36 professional Oregon economists who have signed a letter advocating carbon pricing to create incentives for reducing greenhouse gas emissions here in Oregon. I have provided a copy of this letter and a list of signatories for the hearing record. The drafting committee, which was made up of 5 top environmental and natural resource economists in the state, all the PhDs have international reputations. All 36 economists support this statement because we see carbon pricing as an absolutely critical market-based step to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. The logic for this claim is simple. If emitting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere is free, people will think it doesn't matter if we emit more. This is exactly the wrong message. Only by accounting for the cost of carbon emissions and harnessing the power of the free market can we hope to reduce our emissions. The Oregon Economist letter advocates a largely revenue-neutral carbon tax as a particular mechanism for pricing carbon. I hope to emphasize that our professional economist signatories are not wedded to a carbon tax as a pricing mechanism, as we know this committee is considering at least three different options. All signatories recognize that policies must be tailored to particular times and places. Carbon taxes are a solid, well-respected, and well-used way to price carbon. About 40 countries and more than 20 subnational jurisdictions have adopted some form of carbon pricing. The critical point, though, is that we do something. Things that are free get overused, and in this case, it is our climate that's being overused. Carbon pricing can fix that in an efficient, fair, and transparent way. A well-crafted carbon pricing policy is simple and doesn't involve a lot of bureaucracy to operate. It reduces emissions by harnessing the power of the market to bring about innovation. Businesses will appreciate the policy's clarity and flexibility as they respond. It is a good policy for Oregon. A recent study commissioned by the Oregon legislature, as well as studies in California, which you've recently heard about, and nationally suggest that pricing carbon will have little or no short-term adverse impacts on standard economic outcomes like jobs and output. But carbon pricing will help Oregon do its part to avoid the adverse impacts of carbon change. For our children and our children's children, the time periods of the next 20 to 100 years are just around the corner. We need to act now in order to have time to reduce carbon gas emissions adequately and successfully. By adding a price signal for carbon-based fuels, carbon pricing provides flexibility and allows firms and individuals to reduce their climate impacts in ways that make sense for them. Indeed, nobody is told what to do. Oregon businesses will have the incentives but not be forced to find and use less pollution-intensive methods. Stimulating our economy and innovation in ways to develop clean energy technologies. In sum, my fellow professional economists and I are saying that it is a carbon pricing policy done right is an effective way to help reduce the costly and potentially catastrophic effects of climate change. The market incentives and flexibility of carbon pricing offers the potential for helping to reduce climate risk without the adverse effects on the economy. Oregon has the opportunity to lead the nation with this common sense, market-based approach. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you so much for your testimony today. Okay. So we're going to have next. We're going to invite our own Representative Barnhart and Representative Buckley, as well as Tom Bowerman and Julia Olson, to come up. Representative Buckley. Okay. Do we have Julia Olson?
Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Tom Bowerman. I'm a policy researcher and the principal author of 3470. Although there are many people that contributed to this, policy advisors and lawyers. Hi. The 3470 was really designed to achieve not a carbon tax, but a greenhouse gas reduction policy. Its goals were defined by to achieve the emission objectives that were passed by the state of Oregon in 2007, which we are not making because they are only goals and they are not they do not have any mandate. It's designed to be politically feasible, navigate Oregon's constitutional provisions about fuel taxation, help the economy, be fair to at-risk populations, contribute to a larger regional or national greenhouse gas policy, remain flexible with the best science, technology, and changing conditions, and reflect the preference of Oregon citizens. The piece of paper that I just handed out to you, if you do the flip side, you'll see some results. These are a quick survey that we did just a couple of days ago. They reflect evidence that we've collected over the last 4 years. It's very stable. We had intended to deliver to you an Oregon sample, but we had a little problem with our contractor on a snag on scheduling that can be delivered to you later this week.
We'll make it available to the committee.
I will skip the more specific items on the list that I gave you to give more time for the public. I think 3470 provides the best opportunity to achieve the objectives of reducing carbon emissions in the state of Oregon and play that part. And I would offer that the priority request is to pass 3470 to the full House with a do-pass recommendation. And if it turns out that if this committee does not have the will to pass this bill outright, it should be scheduled for a work session wherein it can be evaluated more comprehensively than possible in this hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Peterson and members of the committee. I'm the executive director of our Children's Trust. I want to address three reasons why this committee and the entire legislative assembly.
Can you please state your name as well?
Julia Olson.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to address three reasons why this committee and the entire legislative assembly should move quickly forward to refine and then pass House Bill 3470 during this legislative session. First, the climate emergency requires an effective law informed by science. 8 years ago, policymakers around the world thought that we could limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures and 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide. They were wrong. As the Washington Department of Ecology said in a report to the legislature in December of 2014, in order to prevent dangerous climate change, they and many scientists believe that the safe level of carbon dioxide for our atmosphere and our oceans is no higher than 350 parts per million, a level that we exceeded the year the Berlin Wall came down in 1989. They also say that if we delay action by even a few years, the rate of reduction needed to stabilize the global climate would be beyond anything achieved historically, and it would be more costly. With only 0.8 degrees of warming so far this century, we have locked in the permanent disintegration of the West Antarctica and now the East Antarctica ice sheets, which could lead to a 20 to 24 foot rise in sea levels within the lifetimes of children born today. Nothing short of comprehensive and targeted emission reductions will prevent further irreversible impacts. HB 3470 responsibly uses current science to set mandatory limits on Oregon's emissions, and it has built-in flexibility to respond to new science as that information develops. It also uses constitutionally sound market-based mechanisms and other discretionary agency tools to achieve the limits. The second reason you should act is you have a legal obligation to do so. One of the most essential purposes of government is to protect crucial natural resources, such as our air and water, for the survival and welfare of both present and future citizens. This fiduciary obligation is firmly rooted in the law, specifically the public trust doctrine, and also in our inalienable constitutional rights. Just last month, the Oregon Supreme Court affirmed that it is the duty of the legislature to enact such laws as will best preserve the subject of the trust and secure its beneficial use in the future to the people of the state. HB 3470 protects public rights in the atmosphere free from dangerous levels of carbon emissions while still allowing for the private and public emissions within the limits that would still prevent dangerous climate change. Legislatively capping private uses of a public resource is a traditional mechanism that has been used in many contexts. Consider fishing quotas, water rights allocations, or even speed limits on our public highways. As public trustees, you would be preserving the public's rights in the atmosphere for climate stability. And my last point is simply that this is really a defining and an historic moment. All of the top scientists in the world say that we will lock in climate impacts for future generations this decade. What you, our public trustees, do after this hearing today and during this legislative session matters immensely. Unlike other social justice issues, from the suffrage movement to the civil rights movement to the marriage equality movement, where children of a later generation could correct the injustices of their forefathers and their foremothers, our children will not be able to correct this injustice once we have passed climate tipping points and have caused runaway heating. It is incumbent upon you to protect the public trust resources of this state, as well as the constitutional rights of our youngest citizens to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Nothing poses a larger threat to those rights than climate destabilization. So thank you for moving HB 3470 to enactment.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. I came here as a member in 2001 to work on school funding. In recent time, in the last couple of years, I have come to realize that the even more critical issue that has to be dealt with is climate change and carbon, the introduction of excess carbon in our atmosphere. Oregon, of course, is a very small state and a very small place in the world, and yet the world is the place that needs to work on climate change. So why are we talking about a bill like House Bill 3470, which can at most affect what we do in Oregon? And I submit it is because we have an obligation to do our part. The United States consumes more fossil fuels and produces more carbon per capita than anywhere else in the world. China has caught up with us in terms of total carbon production, but the United States still produces way more than anyone else does in terms of individual per capita use. So bills like this become critical. You've just heard the timeline issues, and I think they're critically important. I have reviewed Tom's bill, the bill that I sponsored, House Bill 3470, and that Representative Buckley has sponsored, carefully. I think this bill is ready to work. I believe this bill, which emulates the AB Assembly Bill 32 in California, will get us to the place where we can actually start the process of doing the studies, building the regulations, and taking into account all of the different issues that are important in pursuing this kind of study, and this kind of action plan, and this kind of rule, and this kind of reduction in greenhouse gases. The timelines are in Section 10, and I refer you to page 6. I won't read them. But they're reasonable, they're doable, especially given the fact that California has spent a long time, almost a decade, getting to the point where they are now in this process. We do not have to reinvent the wheel. There are many pieces of the California and Oregon are different places, but there are many pieces of the work that they have already done that we can review, consider, and perhaps even adopt ourselves. But even if we don't adopt them specifically, we can move ahead with the issues that are very similar to theirs. This doesn't get us to a program, to a rule, until January of 2018. That's line 20, 37 in Section 10 on page 6. So there isn't any time to be wasted. I understand that many people in the legislature consider this to be a heavy lift. It's only a heavy lift from a short-term political point of view. It is not a heavy lift at all from the standpoint of what we need to do in order to do our small part in order to deal with climate change. Tom Barrowman has written a very good bill. We've gotten a good bill from LC. It's ready to work. One of the things that I find especially attractive about this bill is that it does require that we work with other states and the Canadian provinces and other countries in the process of developing the reduction in greenhouse gases that we have to get to. A couple of other points quickly. The economics of renewables is significantly improved over just a few years ago. The costs of renewable energy systems are dramatically declining. Our understanding of how we do insulation, how we deal with the conservation of energy, all of these things is dramatically improving. We are at a point where the kinds of things that this bill does will actually improve the state's economy, increase jobs in the economy, not decrease them, will actually put us in a better place. You can look back on this bill as a very successful outcome in the long run for the state of Oregon, with an improved economy, a better school system budget, and the other outcomes that these two have already talked about. I consider it to be critical. As far as I know, the fiscal has not yet come to the committee on this bill. I would ask that the work session be held over specifically today so that we don't miss the deadline until that fiscal is available. If the fiscal is significant, and I frankly don't know whether it is or not, then I would recommend that the bill go to the Ways and Means Committee and give us a chance to make the argument there. I think over the next couple of years, the fiscal, considering the outcomes that this bill can produce for us, the fiscal is modest for the operations of the Environmental Quality Commission and the Department of Environmental Quality and the work groups, commissions, or whatever they're called in here, that are set up by this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate your kind attention.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, I am Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. I can only add my support for what's been said here. You've heard some great testimony. I'd also just want to add my sense of urgency. We must act. This is a moral imperative for us. It is the issue of our time. I'd like to waive the rest of my time. I don't take any more time because I know you have people here that want to testify on the bill, including some constituents of mine that came up from Jackson County. But I urge the committee to act, and I appreciate your time and consideration.
Thank you so much. Thank you all very much for your testimony. So we do have many, many people signed up to testimony. As I said at the beginning, we're not going to have a chance to get to everyone. I do want to try to be cognizant of those who've traveled more than 100 miles from this meeting. So with that said, I'm first going to call up Stuart Leibowitz, Austin Anderson, Savannah Jones, Sam Becker, Jaden Becker. Is that four?
So.
Oh, that was five.
So.
Welcome. And we're going to go ahead and limit everyone's testimony to about 90 seconds.
Ready? Go.
Yes, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm speaking on behalf of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition.
Oh, and you need to state your name for the record.
Stuart Leibowitz.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representing over 400 citizens in our community, and we urge you to support legislation to cap and significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Both House Bills 3250 and 3470 accomplish this goal. Placing a price on greenhouse gas pollution is an effective and fair way of addressing climate change. Any carbon pricing bill must be built on the twin pillars of effectively reducing emissions while doing so fairly and equitably. These bills not only meaningfully reduce emissions in a reasonable time frame, but contain mechanisms that ensure the economic well-being of our citizens. And for rural communities such as Douglas County, which need to diversify their economic base, these bills will serve as an incentive for the development and use of clean energy technologies and the jobs they will bring. Sadly, our rural communities are particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, and in timber-dependent Douglas County, droughts, diminishing snowpacks, and wildfires are threatening lives and livelihoods through insect outbreaks and diseases traced to higher temperatures, which are causing widespread tree die-off in the Pacific Northwest. So today we have a choice. Either we conduct business as usual with unacceptable consequences to follow, or we can take responsibility and leave for our children a safe climate and a healthy, vibrant, clean energy economy. We must put a price on carbon or pay the price of carbon. We urge you to support House Bills 3250 and 3470 to cap and reduce carbon pollution and protect our state and future generations.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Savannah Jones, and I am testifying in support of 3250. As a millennial woman growing up in Bend, Oregon, I have seen how the environment is the foundation to our economy, our lifestyle, and our wonder. It is important that Oregonians and our representatives step forward to address climate change with urgency and bravery. Now is the time to set a precedent for protecting our environment, people, and the economy. By putting a price on carbon and giving 100% of the revenue back to Oregonians as dividends, House Bill 3250 is both fair and effective. The price of carbon must rise to reflect its true costs for a sustainable society. Economists have calculated that to transition off of dirty energy at the rate we need, the price of carbon must rise to hundreds of dollars a ton. As a young college student and consumer, I am here to emphasize that at the same time that House Bill 3250 is based on the pollution reduction goals we must meet for a livable future, this bill is financially fair for low-income families and folks like me. Carbon pricing is a social justice issue, one that I want to see spearheaded now, before I graduate from college in the spring of next year. Now is our chance to act in concert and focus on one of the biggest and most urgent crises of our time. Oregon must be at the forefront of carbon pricing legislation in order to make certain a future for my generation and our children. Carbon pricing is a bipartisan issue because we all share this
plan. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello, my name is Sam Becker, and I'm a senior at St. Mary's High School in Medford. One of my passions is environmental work, and I've done environmental work since I was just a young child. And as I've progressed, I've really came to the conclusion that we do need a solution to the emissions pollution, and therefore I really support 3250 for a few reasons. One of them being the fact that I'm from a family whose income isn't very high, and some recent tragic events have wreaked havoc on that income even more. And so while I am all for carbon pricing, my family is a little bit scared at the thought of having to pay more for our energy, and therefore we believe that the dividend part of 3250 is a really great aspect of it, and the fact that we fall into the two-thirds who will actually be coming out with a positive return is very appealing.
Thank you very much.
My name is Austin Anderson. I'm an intern with Oregon Climate, and I'm from Bend, Oregon. According to NASA, 97% of climate scientists agree that warming trends observed by four different international science institutions are related to human activity. These institutions range from the American Medical Association, the Geological Society of America, and the United States Academy of Science. Additionally, according to the Yale Project on Climate Communication, 63% of American adults think climate change is happening. In my opinion, the mainstream media in the United States has turned this into a hot button left versus right issue when it needs to be focused on as a comprehensive human issue as it affects all of us, donkey or elephant. This is why I support House Bill 3250, and I think it would successfully provide the framework to bring our greenhouse gas emissions 85% below 1990 levels by 2050, which would match the required reduction rate to avoid a 2 degree Celsius rise in global temperature levels. Oregon has a chance to inspire nationwide climate action with this bill and also dispel the accusation that climate change is a hoax in order to expand government power. As a college student who will be graduating next spring, I see extreme importance in a carbon price, as my generation will be the one that must lead the transition off of fossil fuels to cleaner, more efficient forms of energy. Noting steady change in public opinion about the climate and the environment, I'm hopeful that the United States can begin to work towards a more sustainable future, and I'm speaking to you to advocate my support for Oregon to pioneer the country forward.
Thank you very much. Okay, so next up we are going to have Deb Evans, Rob Schaaf, Alex Harris, and Larry Burnham. On deck next, we're going to have Varner Seaman, J.L. Wilson, and Mike Fries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ron Schaaf. I'm from Southern Oregon, private timberland manager in support of House Bill 3470.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. My name is Deb Evans, for the record. I'm from Southern Oregon. We are part of a group called Hair on Fire. We're were inspired to stand up here before you today to really try to express how much urgency we feel is needed around this issue. I think it's clear from the people that are sitting in this room that we feel very strongly that we cannot wait. This is an issue that needs to be decided this legislative session. We are here in support of Bill 3470. We think it's the best option for Oregon to move forward on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Alex Harris. I'm a recent graduate from the University of Oregon. And as a citizen of Oregon who is concerned about my future and the future of my generation and my children's generation, I am very concerned about this bill passing, especially this legislative session. I think it's so important that we show the rest of the United States and the rest of the world how Oregonians view climate policy and how we take it seriously and how we won't even be leaders if we pass 3470. We will be following the leadership of states far more progressive and far more future-looking than our state currently is. So my support is in that bill. I think your support should be as well, and hopefully we can do something to get it through this legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Larry Barham. I'm a forester and landowner, primarily forest land in southern Oregon. I've lived on the same piece of property for 35 years. I live off-grid and have personally planted over 1 million trees, seedlings. I feel like I've done my part, and I think climate stabilization is probably the most important issue that we're all facing today. And I'm here to support 3470. And ask for your support in moving this legislation forward. I think it's the most important thing that we can all do together right now to save our planet.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming here to talk today. All right, next up we have Varner Seaman, J.L. Wilson, and Mike Fries. And after that, we're gonna have Ellen Zelenka, Pam Wood, Sam Alloy, and Walt McKesky. Oh, Walt, yes.
We're trying to get a lot of different folks from different committees. Okay, thanks.
Did we lose Varner?
He's here.
Okay. He's on his way. He's in another meeting.
Yeah, I know. All right, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries. I represent Associated Oregon Industries. We represent we have about 1,500 businesses we represent, as well as who employ about 200,000 people. I think as a preliminary matter, AOI is opposed to House Bill 3250, House Bill 3252, and House Bill 3470. And there are a number of reasons for that, but because we have such short time, I've submitted written testimony for your review. But I think one of the major concepts that I hope that we can take away from this is that climate change is a problem, and we recognize that. The other thing that's important to recognize is that whatever we do in the state may not change the trajectory of that. However, Oregonians, Oregon businesses, ratepayers are going to be forced to pay for that non-change and potential leakage, as economists call it, in moving businesses out of this state. And it's important to remember that as we look into the future and try to do things, we need to look at ways that can advance economic prosperity of the state, retain jobs, as well as try to find different ways to innovate, to become more energy efficient and smarter, but not at the expense of Oregon businesses. So with that, I'll just leave you with my written testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. We're 57 of Oregon's leading manufacturers, wood products companies, food producers. We've got 160 facilities in Oregon, and we employ 170,000 Oregonians with family wage jobs. I think it's important to state how successful we've been to date with regard to reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. We're 12% below 2000 levels, simply because industry has been ahead of the curve. It's also important to note we're currently complying with federal 111D regulations, which come at a significant cost to our members, but we do that, and we project that those costs will be approximately 12 to 17% in additional energy costs for us. We have worked as an association to try to quantify what it means with regard to carbon taxes and what that translates into costs for our members, who, again, are Oregon's leading employers. With regard to a $30 per ton cost on carbon, that translates roughly into a $347 million increase in energy costs for Oregon's large commercial and industrial users. That's about a 22% rate hike, especially for our industrial-owned customers who are customers of the investor-owned utilities. It's really hard to see manufacturing succeeding and maintaining some sort of a competitive edge with those types of costs that aren't being borne by competitors in other states. And that hopefully is a factor in your consideration.
Thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, here representing Portland General Electric. I've testified in front of this committee a number of times before on the existing programs that we have in place in the state and the work that we're already doing to work on reducing carbon emissions. It's something that we take pretty seriously, and I think that we're spending quite a bit on, and we're spending a lot of time and energy on. The main statistic I want to remind you of that we've talked about before in this committee is that for Portland General Electric, with significant load growth occurring within our service territory, by 2030, our emissions level will be 17% below 2005 levels. I'm sitting in the screen to my right here. There's a graph that was presented earlier talking about energy consumption since 1965 in a holistic sense. That's not the story in Oregon. We've got a pretty different perspective in terms of what we're doing in the state, and I don't want to belabor that more. I think there are two questions when we look at new or future carbon pricing or some of the policies that are under consideration today that this committee should have in mind. One is figuring out what the mechanism is for actually achieving the emissions reductions that folks are talking about. In hearing some of the earlier testimony on the TV out in the hall, which is an imperfect way to watch testimony, but taking a shot at it, one of the things that's different about Oregon's electrical mix, and speaking just on the electricity side from some of the other areas that are discussed, one is we don't have a market in the Pacific Northwest. When we talk about our integrated resource planning that we do here and we talk about the acquisition of resources here, if you consider Oregon relative to what happens in New England or the Northeast states, in other parts of the
country.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, we are going to have Ellen Zelenka, Pam Wood, Sam Alloy, and Walt Minkowski. What I'm trying to do is get a bunch of different groups who came in here today to make sure we've got some folks from all the different groups that are here. So thank you very much. Why don't you go ahead and start?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Sammy Alloy. I represent Oregon Working Families. We represent around 10,000 registered voters from around the state and about a dozen labor affiliates. We're not climate experts by any means, but we do know that Oregon working families depend on the health and stability of Oregon's economy in order to survive and prosper. And our state's economy depends on our state's natural beauty and our natural resources. Communities across the state depend on our fisheries, our forests, our farms and vineyards, our beaches and slopes to put food on the table. And we know that global warming and ocean acidification threaten our state's economic well-being. The time is now to act. Many people have said that. So I'll just say that we support the bills before you today. And we know that in California, we appreciated that labor had a strong seat at the table, and we hope that that can be the case in Oregon as well. We also support the inclusion of an environmental justice task force so that the benefits can go to Oregon's most impacted communities, low-income communities, and most particularly communities of color, and that we would appreciate special consideration and protection for workers in high energy intensive industries and consideration of how to maximize the best living wage green jobs being kept in our state.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Peterson and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Alan Zelenka. I'm a Eugene City Councilor in my third term. I'm a member of the Eugene City's Sustainability Commission and the Energy Services Leader for Kennedy Jenks, where I work with customers all over the up and down the West Coast on energy efficiency, renewables, and climate change issues. Formerly an electric utility power manager for over 20 years. Formerly the chair of the Climate Trust, and I'm also appointed by the governor as a voting member of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. But I'm not representing any of those roles today. I'm only speaking by myself in remarks or solely my own opinions. We have an opportunity to act at the state and local level to combat climate change, but if we fail to act, the impacts of climate change will be profound and expensive. Climate pollution not only threatens public health, but exacerbates climate change and contributes more to more frequent and more violent extreme weather events that will cost our communities billions of dollars every year. And dealing with climate change is one of the most important actions of our time. At a local level, Eugenians are taking action to reduce our carbon footprint. Several years ago, we created a climate and energy action plan with specific steps to reduce climate and greenhouse gas emissions. And most recently, I authored the Climate Recovery Ordinance, which was passed in 2014. Eugene's Climate Recovery Ordinance puts into law our unanimously adopted citywide goals to reduce our city-owned facilities' carbon footprint to become climate neutral by 2020, and also to reduce our community-wide fossil fuel by 50%.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Pam Wood, and I come here mostly as a mother, also as a counselor who's worked with teenagers for 23 years. I feel really worried about their future. This is an urgent issue. The fears that they share with me include things like, will there ever be a time in our lives when we don't have to worry about climate change? And unfortunately, I have a hard time finding reassurances for them. I face my own fears too, of course. Many of my students are also angry, and rightly so, at the carelessness with which our generation has plundered their world, while so many carry on with business as usual, silent about the things that really matter for their future. I fear, as my children and my students are preparing for college, career, and family, that the shadow of climate change robs their future choices of reality and meaning. Our Earth is not a commodity. Our atmosphere isn't a dumping ground. Our planet is a sacred, alive, and interconnected miracle. Yet protecting our life support system has become controversial somehow in today's heated political climate. Our children's voices challenge us to pry ourselves out of this deadlock. They beckon us to take a wider view, to break out of ingrained ways of relating to the planet, and carve out a viable, healthy, life-sustaining future. House Bill 3250 offers the kind of hope that our children need. It puts in place sensible limits to carbon pollution, which today goes unchecked. It offers a bold and sensible solution and matches the gravity of our climate issue.
Thank you.
And promises real change.
Thank you.
Chair Peterson and members of the committee, my name is Walt Minkowski. I'm a registered professional engineer in the state of Oregon. I designed water and wastewater treatment plants as my primary career. For the last 10 years, I've been doing energy efficiency work in those plants, as well as pulp and paper. I support House Bill 3250 because it puts a price on carbon. I have been so frustrated in my work by presenting energy efficiency projects that involve capital expenditures to industries and municipalities and have been told, gee, Walt, great project, but the price of energy is too cheap. We are not putting the correct price signal in the market, especially in terms of electricity that's supplied by our investor-owned utilities, Pacific Power and Portland General Electric. We need to put that proper price
on that resource so that energy efficiency can become a viable means of reducing emissions. Secondly, the cap, the dividend that would be generated from this revenue of selling cap and trade allowances needs to be returned to the individuals so that there is no detrimental impact on those who can least afford the price increases in energy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, the next panel I'm calling up is the last one. We do have a great number of people. I want to thank everyone who came here, especially for those of you who traveled. Even though everyone didn't get a chance to testify, your numbers show your concern about this issue and the importance it has for you. And so I want to thank you so much for your time. So the last panel is going to be Peter Corneliuson, Mike Belliston, Mark DeWert, and Marilyn Sewell.
Shall I begin?
Yes, please go ahead and get started, and we'll give everybody a chance to come in.
I appreciate this opportunity to speak. My name is Marilyn Sewell, and I'm the Minister Emerita of the First Unitarian Church in Portland. I want to speak from a moral perspective. We all know the dangers of global warming, and we know that we are at a point of crisis. This is not the first time that humans have despoiled the Earth, but it is the first time that we have held the fate of the Earth and her creatures in our hands. I am frightened for future generations, and I have been thrown into deep grief myself every day. Both conservative and liberal economists favor a carbon tax as the ideal way to reduce harmful emissions. I hope that Oregon will enact such a tax, continuing our role as an environmental leader, and then seeing other states follow. Our Oregon legislature has the power to make a difference. In this, the most important moral issue of our day, I urge you to support carbon pricing for our state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Peter Corneliuson. I'm a Hood River City Council person, but my remarks today are my own. As elected officials, today we stand at a crossroads. Are we going to exert leadership to confront and deal with climate change? Or are we going to continue to ignore it and leave the problem to our children? On March 2nd, the city of Hood River answered this question by voting to ask you, the state legislature, to carefully impose a price on carbon in the form of a fee, tax, or cap, with special attention paid to mitigating the impact on low-income Oregonians. Our county's largest employer, Mount Hood Meadows, testified in support of this resolution. Enacting a price on carbon is a priority for our Hood River citizens because we can see the impacts of climate change happening all around us. Mount Hood has one of the lowest snowpacks ever recorded at just 11% of normal, and the orchards in the Hood River Valley depend on this snow for summer water. And this year it's going to be in short supply. Our summer forest fire season is coming sooner, lasting longer, with greater intensity. Anyone who's in touch with nature can see the changes happening and accelerating. The climate is changing faster than we are. We are fortunate to live in a state where our former leaders made good decisions for the future. The legacy of Oswald West, Tom McCall, and other great Oregonians has given us public beaches and wise land use planning. How will you, our current leaders, rise to the challenge of climate change? The citizens of Hood River and Oregon are awaiting your answer.
Thank you.
Chairman Vega Peterson and members of the committee, my name is Mark DeWert. I'm the Building Performance Executive at McDonnell Miller Facility Solutions. I'm here today to support carbon pricing in Oregon. First, let me tell you a bit about McDonnell Miller. Simply, we make buildings work better. We employ roughly 800 people across the Pacific Northwest, and we emphasize operating our business in a low-carbon way. We enable our customers to do the same through energy efficiency engineering measures in the built environment. As the mechanical contractor of choice in Washington and Oregon, McDonnell Miller provides mechanical engineering, design, build, construction, metal fabrication, building systems, maintenance, and energy management programs. We are committed to managing our business activities and internal practices in a sustainable manner, including our best efforts to reduce the carbon footprint. At McDonnell Miller, we believe Oregon's business community is at its best when operating efficiently. That is when the greatest opportunities to compete and be successful. We see carbon pollution simply as excess waste. Whether it's wasted energy in buildings or fuel in vehicles, these carbon pollution waste streams are a sign of the economy's inefficiency. We have inefficiency in our economy, and our competitiveness suffers. Putting a price on carbon waste will send the correct economic signals to the marketplace and will drive investments in efficiencies and low carbon fuel sources. It will also help accomplish the goals we have to enhance the business climate in this state.
Thank you.
Hello, thanks for having me here. I'm Mike Beilstein. I'm a city councilor in Corvallis. Corvallis is established the goal this year of creating a climate action plan. We have done a lot of work on sustainability through the years, and we intend to enhance that this now. So I think next Monday I'll be hearing a hearing very much like what you're hearing from citizens who want us to be aggressive in our climate action plan. I'd say overall that we have a problem with the economy that this resource, which is available to everybody, that is the ability to dump things into the atmosphere, is being overused because it's not priced, because there is no price for carbon emissions. I think it's essential for fairness that when we reach this point where we can no longer use that resource any longer, dumping carbon into the atmosphere without disrupting our existing civilizations and life systems, that we have to start putting a price on it. If there is no price on carbon, then there's no incentive for people rationally to not do it, consumers or producers. So I think this carbon pricing is essential. I know you have three different or maybe even more options which you might follow, but anything that puts a price on carbon, I think, is valuable and necessary for the Oregon economy, the Corvallis economy, and the world economy. Corvallis is only about 2% of the people of Oregon. Oregon is only about 1% of the population of the United States, and the United States is only 5% of the people in the world. So we're talking about very small numbers, but somebody has to take the leadership. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Thanks, everyone, for coming today. I'm going to go ahead and... No, I'm not. Sorry. Okay, that's okay. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3250, 3252, and 3470. Just one announcement. I will be carrying over the work sessions to Thursday, April 16th for House Bill 3068, House Bill 3254, House Bill 3250, House Bill 3252, and House Bill 3470. With that, I'm closing the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you. With that, I'm closing the meeting of the House Energy